Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. How do we begin to create laws and legislation for a frontier that we're not even sure how we'll be interacting with in the next 10, 20, 100 years? Our first story from the wonderful podcast, Life of the Law, provides a great overview of the history of space law in the United States, as well as a look at where the future of out-of-this-world legislation seems to be going.
Mr. Chief Justice, the pleas of the court.
The funny thing about Star Trek is there's no lawyers on the ship. You ever notice that? They're so enlightened in the future, there doesn't seem to be a real need for lawyers in Star Trek.
This is Life of the Law. I'm Nancy Mullane. So we've landed on the moon and maybe discovered there's life on Mars. And not only are we curious, some people are hoping to make money from outer space. Because for all of us, space is the next frontier. And the U.S. Congress just might make all of it possible. They just passed a bipartisan bill known as the Space Act that sets guidelines for how to do it. Next step is for President Obama to sign it into law or veto it. And all signs point to him signing it in short order. And if he does sign it, what sort of 21st century gold rush are we all looking at? Less than 60 years ago, the idea of humans going into outer space seemed like an impossible, wild, irrational fantasy. But once man set his first foot on the lunar soil, we've all been faced with a really practical question. How do all of us humans down here on Earth share space? How do we create a body of law that governs the great unknown? Life of the Law's Kirsten Jesuits-Heidel has the story.
Imagine it's 1957. It's the middle of the Cold War, and fear is everywhere. Senator Joseph McCarthy's just spent years accusing people of being communists and spies. The Soviet missile crisis is on the horizon. The United States and the former Soviet Union are locked in an arms race. And there's a space race, too. When you look up at the sky in 1957, there's nothing up there but stars, planets, moons, and some space rocks. It's a vast, silent sea, utterly unexplored. The only thing anyone has seen orbiting the Earth is the moon. But the U.S. and the Soviet Union are desperately competing to see who will be first to launch a man-made satellite into orbit. For most people at the time, all of this seemed really abstract, if not fantastical. Aviation was just 50 years old. Going into space was something that only happened in science fiction. Until it wasn't.
CBS Television presents a special report on Sputnik 1, the Soviet space satellite.
On October 4th, 1957, the former Soviet Union launched a polished metal sphere into low Earth orbit. It was just 23 inches in diameter and had four external radio antennae. But just like that, the first leg of the space race was over. The Soviets had beat the Americans. And then the so-called Sputnik crisis began.
And when Sputnik was launched, it caused fear and panic, not only in the United States, but around the world. A lot of people were really fearful of what is that metal object in the sky and what is it going to do?
That's Steve Mermina, a law professor at Georgetown University.
Some of these current vibrations in Washington.
Well, there's very profound concern here, Doug, about world opinion. The dominant conflict of our time, the Cold War, is at present, as everyone knows, in a state of balance between Russia and the West.
Is it going to drop weapons? Is it going to deliver weapons? Is it going to threaten us as a race or a nation or as a species?
...months been threatening nations who grant bases to America. Those threats have not been taken very seriously, but now the world knows that it took a far more powerful projectile than America possesses to push that satellite into its orbit in space. In view of that, Russia's threat may be more effective now.
And as a reaction to Sputnik, countries around the world started to get together and say, we need to study outer space and make some rules as to what can and cannot occur in outer space.
The UN convened an ad hoc committee of nations. It was known as the Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, and its goal was to ensure that space would only be used for peaceful purposes. In 1967, the committee signed its first treaty, the Treaty on Principles Governing the Activities of States in the Exploration and Use of Outer Space, including the Moon and Other Celestial Bodies, better known as
the Outer Space Treaty, and more than 100 countries around the world are party to it. So some people refer to it as the Magna Carta of space.
By 1979, there are four more treaties: the Rescue Agreement, the Liability Convention, the Registration Convention, and the Moon Treaty. And no other treaties have been written since. In just over two decades, a whole new body of law was created, one that has big implications today. Take a bill just passed by Congress called the United States Commercial Space Launch Competitiveness Act of 2015, or the Space Act. This is Joanne Gabrinowitz, a veteran space lawyer.
It's a bill that addresses asteroid mining, space tourism, or what we call human commercial space flight, and remote sensing.
It's likely that President Obama will sign this bill into law. And when he does, it would regulate private companies doing anything from mining asteroids to commercial spaceflight.
As activities continue to develop, then you begin to fashion what has to be done for that specific activity if it's going to be different than what has come before.
But what came before? First, some disclosure. I'm a stone cold nerd, and I'm really into space. Movies about space? I've seen most of them. Shelves full of sci-fi novels. Yep. Star Trek? I frackin' love it. Michael Monero is an attorney and scholar of international space law. Nerding out was what led him to this field. He was already a really big sci-fi fan, and then after law school, he went to China on a fellowship. He saw in the news that the Chinese government was starting to get worried about U.S. involvement in space and the ramifications it would have on China. And he decided
to boldly go where no lawyer has gone before.
The funny thing about Star Trek is there's no lawyers on the ship. You ever notice that? But they're so enlightened in the future, there doesn't seem to be a real need for lawyers in Star Trek.
So maybe there wasn't a lawyer on the USS Enterprise. But here on Earth, there's a lot of people interested in the laws that govern outer space. There's even an institute devoted to it. The International Institute of Space Law. And every year they have a moot court competition for law students. This year, it was held at Georgetown University in D.C.
URA is not liable for the damage done to drop gun by the airburst of SID-1 for three distinct reasons. One, Spider cannot prove...
Audio is a bit fuzzy. Second, it was taken from a video because the competition was close to reporters.
And third, because the liability convention does not apply, we can look to the general principles of international law.
It involved a hypothetical case between two made-up nations, the Sovereign People's Independent Democratic Republic, or SPIDER, and the United Republic of Adventura, or URA. According to the case, both nations wanted to mine from an asteroid called SID-1. After URA accidentally messed with its orbit, SID-1 crashed into Dropgum, a fishing village in Spider. Point is, there's a lot of geeking out to do when it comes to space law. And all this geekery is based on other, more terrestrial laws. Here's Michael Monero.
States undertake an activity. After a certain amount of time, there becomes a custom to that activity, a general consensus that there's a right way to do things. Eventually, that custom is elevated to the point where it has the legitimacy of a norm. And then, at some point, the states decide to write down their norms.
Pretty standard. And space law followed the same path. The only big difference was that the people writing space law were moving really fast and making up rules for places no one had ever been before. Chris Johnson works for the Secure World Foundation. It's an NGO set up to prevent space from being another domain where war is waged. He says that the founding fathers of space law even looked to the Romans.
They had to come up with these rules and figure out, well, where does a state's sovereignty begin from? And it actually goes back all the way back to Roman law, where the state said that they had sovereignty from the heavens all the way down to hell. So when the space age began, they thought, is this just a higher realm than aviation? And this is where it gets tricky.
Tricky because suddenly the heavens had no upper limit.
When you just like look out the window and look up, you think, where does state sovereignty end and where does this freedom of outer space, this what they call international commons, where does that begin?
Good question. And that's the problem with space law. You're trying to impose rules on celestial bodies, on the infinite void.
That's what's kind of still kind of mind-boggling. And that's when I first got into space law. It seemed like science fiction that there'd be something that applies to planets and what we can do on other planets and in outer space. That's just the crazy, you know, reality of it.
Which is why space law began by looking for answers on Earth. Joanne Gabrinowitz.
We can look back to other parts of history. For example, the great age of exploration. They were going to places on the Earth that for them were just as new and adventurous as space is for us. And we learn from their experiences and then we adapt them to the current reality.
Take the Space Act, which now attempts to legislate private activities in space at the national level. It deals with liability for American space tourism companies and rights for U.S. businesses that extract resources from celestial bodies. But some people want an international agreement instead to ensure that all countries will apply space law the same way. If the Space Act is signed into law, it could open up a whole new era of space industry and a whole new era of disagreements about how humans should share outer space. Unlike many other areas of law, space law isn't set in stone yet. New rules are being written, and the old ones are constantly being tested.
And there was a case in Europe where there was somebody who claimed to own the sun because he bought it on the internet, and then there was somebody who got a sunburn, so he sued the guy who owned the sun.
That particular case was easily solved by turning to the Outer Space Treaty. Article 2 states that no one can claim any part of space. So, good news for the man who bought the sun. He couldn't be sued. But the bad news is he never actually owned the sun. Michael Monero says what's truly amazing is that space law is so young. It's still like an unexplored frontier. The final frontier.
And the rules we design today will impact our evolution across the solar system for millennia.
For Life of the Law, I'm Kirsten Josewitz-Heidel.
That story was reported by Kirsten Josewitz-Heidel and Rebecca Shear on the podcast Life of the Law. The episode was edited by Annie Murphy with sound design by Shani Avarem. You can find more stories, audio and print, at lifeofthelaw.org. You're tuned to The Spot, KALW's weekly showcase of the best stories made by indie radio producers and podcasts. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. I want to shift focus away now from our legal realities when it comes to worlds outside our own and focus on the laws of narrative in the fictional worlds that we create. The podcast Imaginary Worlds is a deep and very smart look into theories and inconsistencies behind some of our most beloved science fiction universes. In one of my favorite episodes, the show takes on a pretty exciting theory that's at the base of some of the most popular television crossovers of all time, connecting us all into a vast world that might somehow fit inside one little snow globe.
You're listening to Imaginary Worlds, a show about how we create them and why we suspend our disbelief. I'm Eric Molinsky, and this is Tom Fontana. In the 1980s, he was a writer and a producer on a hospital drama called Saint Elsewhere.
You know, the show was always on the brink of being canceled. Our first season, there were 100 TV shows on the air. There were only three networks, and we were 99th in the ratings.
But the show was critically acclaimed, and the top brass at NBC liked it. So they managed to eke out six seasons.
Rather than do what a lot of people do, which is, oh my God, we're going to get canceled. Let's make it more palatable for the audience. We went out of our way to make it as unpalatable as we possibly could.
And Tom was particularly fond of crossovers.
When I was young, I was a big Beverly Hillbillies, Green Acres, Petticoat Junction fan. And I determined that the only one of the characters that had been on all three series was Irene Ryan, who played Granny.
I've come to take care of Betty Jo's young'un.
We got a baby specialist coming from Beverly Hills.
That is me.
You're a Beverly Hills doctor?
I'd appreciate it if you kept the Beverly Hills part to yourself.
So a character from the Bob Newhart show would pop up as a patient at St. Allegis, the hospital in St. Elsewhere. Or he staged a crossover with Cheers, which is a sitcom, but they filmed their episode like a drama. So when Carla talks trash with the doctors from St. Allegis, there's no laugh track, and it's totally weird.
Hey, hey, everybody! These two butchers work at St. Elsewhere! Welcome to Cheers, Doctors Jekyll and Hyde.
Who recommended this establishment? I overheard Ehrlich talking about it. You'd figure it.
The writers also used to keep a list of every crazy scenario that they would love to do for the finale. So when the show was finally canceled, Tom Fontana grabbed that list off the wall and brought it into a meeting with executive producer Bruce Paltrow. And this was his first idea. Two of the doctors are having a deep conversation in their office, which they often do. And suddenly,
there was a flash, a mushroom cloud, and the two of them went, "Oh my God." And then... And then the show ended.
Very 1980s. Bruce Paltrow was not buying it. So here's Tom's next pitch. Two of the doctors are having a deep conversation in their office, as they often do. And one of them says, "I have a secret that's been weighing on me, and I have to confess it right now."
I was the second gunman in Dallas the day that Kennedy died. And he then opens the drawer, pulls out a gun, and he goes, now that I've told you, I have to kill you.
Bruce Paltrow was not amused. So Tom was like, okay, how about this? Two doctors are having a deep conversation in their office, as they often do. It's snowing outside. We pan back to reveal that the entire hospital is made of plaster, and it's inside a snow globe, which is being held by Tommy, the mute autistic son of Dr. Westfall, who's one of the main characters. But we learn that in the real world, Westfall's not a doctor, he's a construction worker, and another doctor from St. Elsewhere is actually his father, who stays home taking care of Tommy.
Hi, Pop, how are you doing?
Good. How was your day up on the building?
Well, we finally topped off the 22nd story. How's he been? To give you any trouble?
He's been sitting there ever since you left this morning, just like he does every day. World of his own.
Careful with that, son.
So this means that the entire series of St. Elsewhere has just been a fantasy in the mind of this mysterious boy with a snow globe.
And Bruce said, "Well, it's not the worst one. Go ahead and write it."
I don't understand this autism thing, Pop. Here's my son. I talk to him, and I don't even know if he can hear me. Because he sits there all day long in his own world, staring at that toy.
The response in the mail was about 50-50. Half of our audience hated, like wanted to come to the MTM lot and burn us to the ground. And the other half thought it was a fitting part of the show.
Either way, it was all supposed to end right there. Trick ending, nothing more. But Tom Fontana couldn't stop with the crossovers. He went on to produce Homicide: Life on the Street, and he brought over two doctors from St. Elsewhere, even after that show had been off the air for like 12 years. He even staged a crossover with Chicago Hope, which was on CBS, and he purposely didn't show those scenes to the executives at NBC.
So the next Monday after the show aired, Warren Littlefield, who was head of NBC at the time, called me up and goes, "You are a bad, bad boy."
And he found a partner in crime, the actor Richard Belzer, who played Detective John Munch on Homicide.
He was like, "Well, let's see. I could be on all the Law & Order shows." This is before he went over to Law & Order. And bit by bit, they would say, "We want you to be in this." And he'd go, "Well, I have to play Munch."
So Munch talked to the lone gunman on the X-Files.
"Detective Munch, Baltimore Homicide."
"Did they find her?"
"And a good evening to you."
He orders a drink at a bar on the wire.
"Rodney, you can't press a regular for his whole tab. It just isn't done."
And he teaches a class in arrested development.
We supply the glitter, glue, the crepe paper, and the ready-made template pages for you to decorate and fill out with my favorite birthday, foreign bank statements, and of course, family secrets.
This did not go unnoticed. Keith Gow is a playwright in Melbourne, Australia, and he and his friends were talking about this at a pub one night. And they started wondering, does this mean that Arrested Development and The Wire exist in the same universe? And if you can trace all these shows back to St. Elsewhere, does that mean that all of these shows were dreamed up by Tommy Westfall, the autistic kid with the snow globe?
And we started just sort of collating a list of shows, and the further we got into it, the more connections we seemed to find.
So they made a grid of the Tommy Westfall universe, which spanned hundreds of shows, and put it online. And people wrote in from around the world pointing out that Tom Fontana was not the only person fond of crossovers. A lot of TV writers love The X-Files. And as kind of an homage to that show, they like to incorporate the names of fake brands or companies that appeared on The X-Files.
And I think the big one that broke it open was the Morley cigarettes that the smoking man on X-Files smoked suddenly started popping up in other shows. So Spike on Buffy smokes Morley cigarettes as an homage to The X-Files.
The Tommy Westfall theory didn't really go viral until 2002. The late comic book writer Dwayne McDuffie wrote a post complaining that his boss at DC was putting way too much pressure on him to link his characters to other comic books. Which is funny because it's something that DC and Marvel are doing way, way, way more now. I mean, the hot buzzword in Hollywood is having a shared universe. But back in 2002, McDuffie was using Tommy Westfall as an example to prove that a shared universe was ridiculous.
And it's fascinating, the objections that I hear about it sometimes. I don't understand why people take it so seriously. I mean, you can object all you like, but it's just a bit of fun finding the connections. Like, I don't literally think it makes sense that the X-Files and Homicide exist in the same universe.
No, but they could exist in a multiverse. And if you think this thing has gotten weird, it gets even weirder here. The Tommy Westfall theory actually mirrors real scientific theories by physicists who think that our universe may be one of many. Now, scientists don't know if these parallel universes have nearly identical versions of us. I mean, maybe the laws of physics are so crazy over there that if we crossed over to another universe, we just burst into flames. But the latest mathematical models definitely indicate that parallel universes are probably real. And some scientists think that tiny particles might be able to break through the membranes that separate these universes. And the Tommy Westfall multiverse works in the same way, except those traveling particles are Detective John Munch or Morley cigarettes.
Oh, I was stunned.
Tom Fontana was also proud of the fact that Tommy is at the center of this phenomenon.
I think it sort of adds a whole other layer to the idea of what an autistic person can or cannot do in a very bizarre kind of way. You know what I mean? Because it says people have imaginations regardless of what their conditions are. You know, the human mind is an extraordinary thing.
And he thinks having these porous borders is good for creativity. He saw it firsthand when Homicide and Law and Order swapped cast and crew.
What it ultimately does in my mind is enhances the storytelling, mm-hmm. because somehow it frees you to like go to a place where you wouldn't normally have gone within the restrictions of your own genre or your own TV series.
You have a show like, say, Sleepy Hollow, which is a combination of all sorts of different things, which I don't think you could have had 20 years ago, because 20 years ago you either had your cop show or you had your family drama. And now you can have something like Sleepy Hollow, which is a time travel procedural fantasy.
And Sleepy Hollow staged a crossover with Bones, which is a very down-to-earth FBI show.
I actually still have the snow globe upstairs. So.
Really?
Yeah.
So at this point, Tom went up to the second floor of his office, and he came back with the snow globe, the one that Tommy held in that final scene. It was so much bigger than I imagined, like the details and the little plaster hospital inside the glass were kind of amazing.
That's an amazing memento.
Yeah.
Wow. That's so cool.
And as I kept staring into the snow globe, I started thinking. So Tommy dreams up St. Elsewhere. Two doctors from St. Elsewhere appear at Homicide. Munch crosses over from Homicide to the X-Files. The Laureate rental car company from the X-Files shows up on Veronica Mars. Veronica Mars has a boyfriend who works in This American Life, where she meets Ira Glass, who plays himself.
Hi.
Hi. You must be the girlfriend who we have heard so much about and never seen.
I am.
I was on This American Life years ago.
This guy named Eric Molinsky told her about this strangely and unexpectedly fierce argument that he had gotten into with a good friend of his.
That means that half the shows and podcasts out there are actually all part of Tommy Westfall's imagination, including me.
Hey, Pop. How you doing?
Good. How was your day up on the building?
Well, we finally topped off the 452nd story. How's he been? Giving you any trouble?
Tommy? He's been sitting there since you left this morning. Just like he does every day, staring at that snow globe. You know it changes what's inside. Yesterday it was a hospital. Today there's a skeleton key in the sky. It says imaginary worlds or something.
I don't understand this autism thing, Pop. He's my son. I talk to him. I don't even know if he can hear me. He sits there all day in his own world, staring at that toy.
You got a text?
Oh, it's that detective again, Munch.
That's the third time this week. He keeps popping up, doesn't he?
That's it this week. Special thanks to Tom Fontana, Keith Gow, Rob Pruitt, and Bill Lobley.
Ooh, you got a text.
Oh, it's that detective again, Munch. F*** him.
Maybe you should block his calls.
What's that mean?
I don't know. I think you take a building block and you throw it at the phone or something.
You can like the show on Facebook. I tweet at E. Malinsky. Show's website is imaginaryworldspodcast.org.
That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at kalw.org. Look under the Programs tab. I love listening to your suggestions, so please take a moment and share a few of the podcasts that have hooked you lately. Email me at thespot@kalw.org. And tune in next Thursday, same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on KALW San Francisco.